Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Love, you got the power, but you just don't understand.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to have a new in-depth report, a white paper, Creeping Towards Annihilation, the IPCC Report and Beyond, with scholars in residence, Richard Gale, and myself. This is a part of a 10-part series. These are shorter, and they're meant to show you the problem and, more importantly, the solutions that we must embrace in order to prevent cataclysmic events. Following this, I'll do the latest on health and nutrition, then environmental input, and then a commentary. So we have a lot to share, and my hope is that people pay attention because it's important. We have just completed a 2-week retreat for our sister station, WBAI. It was extremely successful. In fact, so successful, the conditions that you would never feel could be improved were actually reversed. And thank goodness we filmed it all. I'll be streaming some of their testimonials on upcoming programs, and some of the things you're going to see, you simply will not believe. But it happened. It's right there in front of you. And now to the staff. And this could not have succeeded without a phenomenal staff of 20 people who came together to help the station. The good news is that we earned enough from this to pay for all 100% of the premiums from our summer drive, plus pay other stations' premiums or other programs on BAI as well. Unfortunately, without that, there was no money to pay anyone anything, to buy premiums at all, which is unfortunate because if you want to lose an audience, promise them premiums, pitch for a month, and then don't deliver them, you'll lose an audience. So we're trying to reverse that trend, and this is one of the ways we can do it. I'll be helping this week now that I'm back, and I have brand new premiums I'll be offering this week. Now to our story. 7 years ago, Professor Guy McPherson, a University of Arizona professor emeritus of environmental science, shared his insights about global warming and its likely impact upon the planet's future. After taking a broad, systematic review of the atmospheric and geological factors contributing to the warming of our planet, McPherson gave humanity a very narrow window of time to get its act together and reduces greenhouse gas emissions. He derived his conclusions from consistent trends that showed earlier forecasts of Arctic ice melt, loss of glaciers, the northern permafrost thaw, methane release, both in the tundras and in the ocean, and other tipping points becoming consistently dire. McPherson also observed large discrepancies between the Conservative Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, reports and actual observations and measurements of climate events. Last January, the IPCC had already started a program that said we must keep below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, the lower limit set by the Paris Agreement. And it was, quote, extremely unlikely that we would do that. That report predicted that we could see such a rise in temperature by 2020. That's just about 9 months ago. This month, the same IPCC is predicting the Earth will warm 1.5 degrees in the next decade. That's a big margin of error. Why? Because they're ultra-conservative when it comes to not wanting to panic people, because they don't want to be held accountable if they're right or wrong, because if you're right, then why didn't you start warning us years ago when that same data was available? So McPherson was not exclusively concerned about global warming reaching 1.5 degrees or more. The planet is currently hovering around 0.9 degrees increase He also took into account other tipping points, the acidification of our oceans, the growing dead zones. There are over 500 now. Some are as large as the state of New Jersey. The bleaching and death of the Great Barrier Reef and other coral reefs. Global deforestation. Degradation of land from factory farming, overdevelopment. Encroaching desertification in Africa, Australia, China, the Middle East, and the Western United States. Extreme hurricanes and typhoons. And the acceleration of an ever-increasing number of positive feedback loops. The environmental evidence of global warming is clear and unequivocal. Droughts and heat waves are longer. Wildfires are more frequent. Storms are more severe. Deserts are expanding at a very rapid rate. And yet modern civilization continues to push forward with this habitual business-as-usual speed, living in complete corporate denial, individual denial, and government denial. In the U.S. alone, average temperatures have increased 1.06 degrees just since 1970. Now, mind you, there's a universal temperature, then there's regional temperatures, which can be much higher. So after reviewing the scientific literature on climate and environmental change for 10 years, thousands of studies that we would review, we became convinced that McPherson was largely correct, although the threshold point of no return remains uncertain. 5 years later, McPherson was no longer alone in addressing worst-case scenarios. A small group, about 15 leading climate scientists with distinguished credentials, concurred with various parts of his hypothesis, including Peter Wadhams of the Cambridge University, Paul Beckwith, University of Ottawa, Henry Pollack, University of Michigan, Jason Box in Denmark, and others. Many scientists were already saying we had run out of time and that it would be impossible to switch from fossil fuels to renewable energies in a timely manner. However, to McPherson's dismay, the larger scientific community, although acknowledging anthropogenic climate change, denied outright the severity of the crisis, according to his timeline. In addition, McPherson and others, such as Russian permafrost expert, probably the leading one in the world, Professor Natalia Shekhovo, and Australian climatologist Andrew McLaxon, were accused of fear-mongering. Meanwhile, the year 2100 remains the popularity concept, meaning we don't have to do anything for the next 80 years. All right? By that time, most people living right now will be dead. Then we will deal with catastrophic events that might threaten humanity's very existence. The mainstream climate institutions' contempt toward scientists willing to break their silence and speak their personal truths show signs of a postmodern environmental McCarthyism. Michael Mann, director of Penn State's Earth System Science Center, tried to equate McPherson and others who share his predictions with climate change denialists in terms of the adverse societal impact they supposedly have. Mann is a prominent voice in the climate movement. However, his refusal to even consider worst-case scenarios, in my opinion, is unscientific and nothing more than institutional hubris. For McPherson, speaking openly about his assessment of the available climate research destroyed his career and forced him to move overseas to Belize. This past August, Professor McPherson joined us in New York for a three-hour interview. We filmed it. It's a part of our new documentary on saving the planet. He now says we have about 7 years before the tipping points of negative feedback loops become irreversible. Quote, look around you. Look at the world. See how many significant weather events have occurred during the past 12 months. California and British Columbia are repeatedly experiencing their worst wildfires. Colorado now has tsunami fires, perfect firestorms reaching 300-foot feet in the air. These were never seen before, end quote, from McPherson. But most of the world's population need not wait 12 years before they feel global warming's impact in the form of smaller crop yields, droughts, food and water shortages, and the rise of diseases associated with climate change. For millions of people, the IPCC forecast is happening right now. They haven't time to wait for developed nations like the United States and China and Germany and others to pull their resources together and act. After Hurricane Maria slammed into Puerto Rico in 2017, a million citizens were displaced out of a population of a little over 4 million. 300,000 fled to Florida. Has that all been corrected? Have they rebuilt infrastructures to withstand the next hurricane? No. Do they put generators capable of supplying energy so that water pumps could work and so at least people would have safe water? No. Did they put together food banks in hurricane-proof concrete buildings so when people didn't have food, they could go, if they were affected, to these shelters and have at least a decent diet? No. Did they build clinics around the island? It's not a large island, Puerto Rico. So when someone's injured or suffering from some waterborne disease, they could go and seek help? No. So what exactly have they done? How about nothing? That's the way it works. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying annually due to events directly linked to climate change. And according to a study published in Nature Climate Change, 30% of the world's land surface, an area currently home to 1.5 billion people, may experience desert-like conditions in the near future. And such drastic shifts in climate will trigger the migration of vast numbers of people. That's according to Jeff Goodell, writing in Rolling Stone, quote, "In the not-so-distant future, places like Phoenix and Tucson will become so hot that just walking across the street will be a life-threatening event. Parts of the upper Middle West will become a permanent dust bowl," end quote. An additional 13.1 million Americans living along the coast will also be forced to migrate as ocean waters rise, and it will be far worse in developing nations. Even though they consume the least amount of fossil fuel, they're also impacted. The IPCC report has reached a critical benchmark for the international community, permitting us to finally, together, acknowledge that the pace of climate change is accelerating far more rapidly than we've been led to believe. How many times on this program have you heard me over the last 10 years say that water's increasing and loss out of Arctic from the ice, and it's heating up? Antarctica, enormous calving, the Larsen B shelf, the Larsen C shelf, these are huge expanses of frozen ice, and they're breaking off. And that even on Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa, a famous mountain, ice is being melted from the top. In Switzerland, they actually lost the highest mountain there, and now it's the second highest because ice melted. We've been telling you this nonstop. Well, for the first time, intergovernment climatologists are being taken seriously. But we do not have until 2100 to launch a planetary Marshall Plan to transition to renewable energies. We only have 12 years by their estimate, 7 years by McPherson and other people, 7 years. And that's at best. That is now the official international word. So at last, viable solutions from the macro to the micro, from a multinational reforestation initiative to a plant-based diet, can be discussed honestly and respectfully. Shortly after the release of the IPCC report, MIT engineer Howard Herzog disputed some of the solutions it presented, stating that we cannot reverse climate change with, quote, negative emission technologies, such as biochar, CO2 capture and storage, direct air capture, geoengineering, ocean fertilization, and chemical alkalinity of the oceans. Professor Herzog argues that looking at that type of solution to save us without immediately weaning ourselves off fossil fuels, quote, is more hope than reality. It would not be the development of new technologies which are extraordinarily costly and economically unfeasible on a mass scale. And it would require enormous rapid deployment that will reduce carbon emissions to meet the IPCC's deadline. Instead, a new intellectual paradigm is demanding that we move quicker. Other critics of the IPCC report argue that the situation is far worse. Janie Hinn of 350.org calls it, quote, a watered-down consensus version. The latest science is much, much, much more terrifying, end quote. In short, the report is still offering governments the illusion that there is time to alter their behavior. The sharpest criticisms came from Mario Molina, who received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his research in the depletion of ozone. Molina writes that the IPCC ignores the fundamental risk of runaway climate change, quote, that self-reinforcing feedback loops could push the climate system into chaos before we have time to tame our energy systems and the other sources of climate pollution, end quote. As severe climate events increase in number and intensity, scientists continue to discover further atmospheric and geological mechanisms contributing to rising temperatures and the warming effects from greenhouse gas emissions. There is still so much to learn. The University of New South Wales, along with researchers from 17 other nations, published a study in Nature Geoscience in July of 2018, warning that current long-term warming trends could be twice as bad as climate models project. The study is more worrisome than the ICPP report predicting that a 2-degree rise is much nearer than expected. Only three times during the past 3.5 million years has the Earth warmed 2 degrees higher than the temperature humans have been accustomed to for the past 2,000 years. Already the Earth is warming, and that has been for the past 120,000 years. However, when climate models introduce greenhouse gases into their equation, they accurately correlate with real-life temperature trends. In the long term, 90% of planetary warming is likely to the actions of our species. The remaining 10%, according to Conrad Steffen, director of the Swiss Polar Institute, quote, is unexplained. For several decades, scientists have been running simulated climate models to determine whether increased warming is anthropogenic, meaning caused by human activity, or part of a natural cycle. Whenever human-generated greenhouse gases, that's CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide and water vapor and dust, etc., are removed from their equations, scientists are unable to figure out what exactly caused it. So was it natural phenomena alone? So the answer is we, humans, are the cause. The IPCC timeline gives us 12 years before we can no longer avoid a temperature rise of 1.5 degrees. However, the IPCC report and forecasts have been criticized for a variety of reasons over the years. First, climate models are based upon mathematical representations of estimated trends, not actual climate events. Climate models also need to be tested to determine their accuracy, and we don't have decades to test them thoroughly. For example, IPCC projections for positive feedback in Arctic sea ice loss were grossly understated. They were wrong, wrong, wrong. All 2,000 scientists, shame on them, because they weren't looking at the obvious evidence here and now. That's the danger of monotheistic scientists who are so detached from the reality outside of their protected tenured positions that they don't actually go in and see for themselves. Well, here's another way of putting it. Why don't you go up to the northern panhandle of Florida and tell the people there that you have 12 years? They don't have 12 seconds. their entire community was destroyed. The entire city was destroyed in under 24 hours. And when that hit as a Category 4, only one mile an hour less than making it a Category 5. What was left? Nothing except heartbreak and dire poverty, because there's no insurance that's going to rebuild their community. And we have this habit of paying all of our attention and showing weathermen faking it or not on the beach, like they're being blown away when some people are walking right behind them, completely normal, and Anderson Cooper standing in a ditch so that it could look like he's submerged in water up to his chest when the camera crew, just 7 feet away or whatever, is standing not in the ditch. This kind of grandstanding is embarrassing. Now talk with the people who have actually been involved. Go to Australia. See the hundreds of thousands of livestock, sheep and cows, starving to death without water because nothing's growing. These are ruminating animals. They need grass. They're not getting it. Farmers cannot afford to feed them, so they're dying. Look at a community. There were 12,000 in China alone that were overtaken by the desert, had to move. Their entire community gone to the desert. The largest sandstorm in American history happened this year. Largest, worst typhoon in world history recorded this year. The highest fires in American history, 300 feet high, this year in Colorado. The whole state of California with multiple fires. Now it's 12 months a year, fires. So go to anyone who's had their house burned down, their house flooded. Go to North Carolina now and ask, who's going to take the water out of your basement? And then what are you going to do when you have to spend tens of thousands of dollars to remove the mold, or you won't be able to stay in there? It'll be unhealthy. And then they say, well, we didn't cover you for water damage, just hurricane wind damage. So you mean when a roof gets blown off in part or whole, and the water comes in by the hundreds of thousands of gallons, and it rots out everything that is structural, you don't cover for that? Just cover for repairing the roof? Yeah. So you see, there's the reality of academia and the scientific enclaves living in their own bubble, and then there's the reality of everyday life where you're actually faced with this. And we never come back 6 months or a year later to see what happened. We didn't go back in Katrina. We didn't go back in Sandy. And we haven't gone back now, nor are we. Because if we did, we'd see that we have changed absolutely positively nothing. Nothing. We are not prepared for any disaster in America. Shame on us. Not just the federal authorities. I didn't expect them to ever do the right thing. Or the state authorities. So what do? Your population's being decimated. And you say, well, we put in for national emergency. Okay, so you get some emergency. Does that mean you're going to repair every home? You're going to actually do something positive? Have an educational program to teach these people they're living in the wrong place? It's not sustainable. Then help them relocate and help subsidize that relocation to a better place? No. Because all these governors, in my opinion, do not want to see their income for the state budgets depreciated by people fleeing a state. I'll put it a simple way. Florida's dead. It's over for Florida. So those who are going to hang out there expect to see a lot more. And what do you think would have happened had Miami got hit with that, or West Palm Beach, with that Category 4, 1 degree, 1 mile an hour less than a Category 5? It'd be over for Miami. Everyone would sell their co-ops, their condominiums, and their houses. It's just a matter of time before that Category 5 hits a big city, and then suddenly everybody goes, what happened? And then you ask yourself, can we prevent this? The answer is no. Those feedback loops have already closed. So we don't have 12 years, even though the ultra-conservative IPCC members, protecting their reputations, minimizing anyone's concern, are going to tell us the truth we're seeing daily around the world. They're not testing their models against accuracy. An analysis in Arctic News based upon estimates of the different greenhouse gas emissions since 1900, assuming nothing substantial changes to reduce emissions, suggests the global temperature could theoretically increase 10 degrees Celsius in the next 8 years. Scientists still debate whether humanity could survive a 4-degree increase. We would not. There wouldn't be anyone left on the planet at 10 degrees. A 10-degree increase is a certain extinction. Yet as early as 2003, a tiny group of climate scientists were giving extremely pessimistic prognosis. Did you see them on television, hear them on radio, see them in popular magazines? Absolutely not. Everything that's negative like that is controlled. That year, Cambridge University astrophysicist and philosopher Martin Rees released his influential Our Final Hour, warning that the pace of humanity's destructive activities gives us only a 50-50 chance of surviving the rest of this century. At the time, the book was considered extreme. Today, Rees's prediction might be regarded as overly optimistic. It is time that governments, corporations, and citizens accept the fact that climate change is the single most important threat to the survival of our species. Certainly, Trump's buildup of high-tech weapons to threaten any nation that defies Washington's unipolar hegemony is horrifying. However, it is within humanity's means to avoid military and even nuclear confrontation. On the other hand, it is highly improbable whether we can do very much to deter climate change. Controlling natural forces is far outside of our technological know-how, even with advances in geoengineering and global-wide carbon sequestering. There's another fact that those who question climate change would do well to remember. Earth's history is one of numerous species birthing, evolving, and eventually going extinct. There is no manifest destiny for our species. There is no divine promise that humanity may not someday follow in the footsteps of the dinosaurs. Our lives do not transcend nature, nor the multitude of other animals, plants, microbes, and other forms down to the molecules upon which our existence depends. This is a simple truth we must learn. But will we? Finally, I do not believe we will learn anything. I believe that most people are going to be adversely affected, and here's why. This is not a negative statement. It is a pragmatic, realistic one. And it comes not from environmental science at all. Again, when you're a monotheistic person, your whole life is focused upon one object, and nothing tangential to that is really understood. But this comes from economics, socialization, and I've observed this in so many of the people that I've interviewed. I've counseled tens of thousands of individuals from all walks of life, from unemployed and poverty-stricken homelessness to billionaires. I've counseled members of a royal family, and always it's with the idea of helping them. But I also try to get some context of understanding, will they make change? Most of the time, that is negative. Do the math, and then answer this for yourself. Watch television. What do you see? The programs are geared towards excessive competition and showing the worst of human nature. We reward winners, and we shun losers. Even if you had a baseball game going 10 hours and someone finally gets a run in, you forget the people who lost and you give all the praise and reward to those who win. We are excessively competitive society. We don't cooperate. We compete. We have the best and brightest professional class in the world that's ever known. And we have the most. We have the most men and women who are now professionals, professors, lawyers, physicians, architects, engineers, consultants. These people are high-end earners. They are highly educated and very well motivated. If you add them together with their families, you get about 68 million people. The other group of people we have are the policymakers. These are people who are heads of hedge funds and equity partners and major CEOs of Fortune 500 corporations. And frequently they're brought in to oversee governmental agencies. Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter. In fact, I absolutely condemn every single appointment by Trump, but I also condemned every single appointment by Obama, since one of the heads of Citicorp gave him a list of people that he should appoint, and he appointed all of them. So Citicorp selected all of our Commerce Secretary and Secretary of State, all of the major positions. So you've got 10 million of those people with families, 40 million. Together, it represents 112 million people, and or one-third of the American population. But here's what's important concerning global warming, and you have to understand this, and that is these are the policymakers and opinion leaders. These are the dynamic energies. They're dynamic aggressives. They're adaptive aggressives. And they're the ones who control or own or founded all the foundations and think tanks from which people go to the Council on Foreign Relations. These are the people that go to Davos. These are the insiders, the Business Roundtable, the Bilderbergs. Every major group of policymakers and opinion leaders, every single seat at the table they fill. They also represent the 164 major corporations that control the vast majority of wealth on the planet. They are not in the business of renewable energies. Now, a few of them might have that, but the vast majority, like the Koch brothers, they're in high-polluting energies. No law will be passed that mandates they must, within 5 years, switch from the type of oil, gas, or nuclear over to a renewable. They would say it would take them 15 years to do so. So nothing has been mandatory, only voluntary. And we've seen that some countries like Denmark and Germany, even China, has begun to do more solar, but also at the same time, to make solar, you have to use these polluting energies. As a result, we will not have any Marshall Plan to help the world. We will be in that kind of vortex of selfishness and self-interest. The wealthy will feel that as long as they can escape an immediate catastrophe, that's all they care about. So they have multiple homes all over the world, and they are actively discussing best places to live when the catastrophes come, because they know it's going to happen. But if you're a working person, you're living in Florida, and you've been there, and the last year, that Category 4 that hit Naples, Florida, and went up the state, didn't hit except as a tropical storm by the time it got to the high end of the state, because Florida's a long state. It takes you 8 hours to drive through it from one end to the other. So these are just average people. And everywhere in America, you have average people. These are mainly tradespeople, school teachers, tradespeople. They have deep roots. Family's important to them. Security is important. So having a job, having a house, food on the table, clothes on the kids, that's important. They're not out there finding ways to change the world, nor are they going to automatically pack everyone else that they know up and suggest, let's move to a safer place. They'll be encouraged to stay where they're at because, after all, the smart people in the room told them, you don't have to worry, you know, and so they didn't. Now their homes are destroyed. Everywhere, these are the people getting creamed. The rich have special insurances, much more comprehensive policies, and they're never there when the storms hit, with rare exception. They're in their other penthouse, New York, or wherever they live. The average person, they don't have a fallback position. They don't have a plan B. Who are the people who are buying constantly? How many Louis Vuitton bags they own at $20,000 or whatever it costs. They're constantly consuming the very thing that, if you were concerned about the environment, you'd be doing just the opposite. Buying less, buying renewable, using paper instead of plastic, or there is now biodegradable plastic. Not buying all the type of furniture historically that would cost a rainforest to be felled to give it. Going on a plant-based diet. Now, right now, we have about 4%, 3.7 to 4% of the population living consciously and ecologically. Those people are not policymakers nor opinion leaders. Many of them are young people who, for different reasons, are going vegan. But that doesn't mean because they're vegan in one space of their life that they're not overspending on stuff in other places of their life. You see this contradiction constantly. Oh, I'm for the environment. I'm for saving animals. Why? Because I don't want to see animals suffer. But your lifestyle is causing an awful lot of methane and greenhouse gases. This Gaia, the completeness, is missed. And as a result, we're not going to change. So my suggestion is this. Just be realistic. Even if it means you have to come out of that cocoon for a moment. Because take a careful look at what happened in Florida. Just be honest. Take a look and ask yourself, wow. Or better still, look at the current issue of EcoWatch. Leslie, Hurricane Leslie, became the rare named Atlantic tropical storm to hit Europe just Saturday. It rammed into Portugal. They were unprepared to have a post-tropical cyclone that injured over 27, leaving 300,000 people without power. Now, Leslie had been downgraded from a Category 1 hurricane before making landfall, but it still lashed Portugal with hurricane-force winds. The seaside town of Defoz recorded winds of 105 miles an hour. They weren't prepared for that because always storms are created in the eastern Atlantic around Africa and move westward to the United States or the tropics. This one in reverse. Unprepared. Uprooted thousands of trees, blocked roadways, including their Highway 1, their main one. And around the capital of Lisbon, there no electricity, hence no water. They were completely unprepared. That's just one example. And we have more examples all over. Look at Panama City, Florida. Hurricane Michael, sudden transformation into an unprecedented storm, creamed the Florida panhandle. It was simply raw power, and you couldn't escape it. What didn't they prepare? They had no food, no water, no FEMA. As a result, Michael's survivors are furious. But before they get too focused upon what the government didn't do for them, why don't you ask them, what did you do on your own to prepare, especially since you had a year to realize you could get hit with a high Category 4 because half of the bottom part of Florida just 11 months ago got hit with Category 4. Nothing. So within a period of 3 hours, total destruction. Unprepared, and they won't be prepared if it's ever rebuilt. We tend not to ever learn any lesson from history. That's part of our upbringing. Always defer to someone else who's going to make it better, correct it, heal it, or prevent it. It doesn't work that way. Driving across the Apalachicola National Forest looked like a dead zone. Electric poles 30 feet high have been split in half. Power lines strewn across the macadam. It went on like this for 60 miles of destruction in all directions. So when you got a storm that's 200 or 300 or 400 foot wide or miles wide, you're going to have destruction, not just immediately in that area, but all the surrounding areas. So I think that we should just pay attention. And by the way, from Umar Haku, they said, why catastrophic climate change is probably inevitable now, how capitalism torched the planet by imploding into fascism. This is interesting. Quote, sometimes we don't pay attention, but here we should. We have just a decade in which to control climate change, or goodbye. An unknown level of catastrophic, inescapable, runaway warming is inevitable. The reality? We're probably going to make it, not make it. It's highly dubious at this juncture that humanity is going to win the fight against climate change. I would agree. I believe that our planet is going to get beaten to a pulp. I believe that we're going to see millions, hundreds of millions of people displaced and a lot more suffer. And the government will be sitting on its hands because it's a capitalist government. And with that, you have fascism. Everywhere you have fascism. Look in Brazil, by the way. Brazil is electing a neo-fascist who plans to raise and sell off the Amazon. That's the world's lungs. Do you think the Brazilian people understand this? If they do, they're not showing by voting against a person that would destroy the last lungs of the planet. They're thriving on this idea. All of it decadent, all of it corrupt, and all of it naive. America's newest Supreme Court justice is already striking down environmental laws in his first few days in office, but he will be on the bench for the rest of his life, beside a president who hasn't just decimated the EPA, but stacked it with a kind of delusional simpletons who think global warming is a hoax. Again, the world is set back by decades, and it doesn't seem to matter. So catastrophic climate change is not a problem that fascists fix. It's a problem that fascists create. History's most perfect, lethal, and efficient one means of genocide ever, period, climate change. Who needs to build internment camps when you have floods and hurricanes? They'll do the dirty work for free. So climate change accords perfectly with the foundational fascist belief that only the strong should survive and the weak, the dirty, the impure, the foul, should perish. That is why neo-fascists do not lift a finger to stop climate change, but do everything they can, in fact, to accelerate it and prevent every effort to reverse or mitigate it. So that's the way it happens. And we then are tied up in our lament, because if it's not happening to us in that moment, we want to watch the ball game or reality show showing us the worst of human nature. So do you really think if we're a society that gloms on to the worst debasement, the worst decadency, the most violent presentations of human nature in world history on television on a daily basis, that we buy everything we can, no matter where it's made, no matter how people are exploited to make it? Do you really think that these people are suddenly going to change anything in their life to prevent climate change? If that's the case, I would beg to differ. So if the professional educated class is not on board because they're into their own careers and lifestyle, they're in debt up to their eyeballs for every dollar they make, they spend, and their children are no better, the progeny are just as equally culpable to selfishness, narcissism, and comfort creatures who will not change. So if the rich and powerful are not going to help, and the poor and delusional are not going to help, who exactly is supposed to make a difference? Who's going to help us change? How about nobody? It'll be a tiny, tiny, tiny segment of the population that actually makes the changes, ethically so and rightly so, that could help. But it'll be too little, too late, because they cannot force the major carbon polluters to change. Robert Hunziker in Counterpunch makes an interesting statement. He says peak carbon emissions by 2020. That's a year and a half from now, or else, quote, world greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2020 or it's lights out. That's the message of the IPCC, which has come out from under the shadows of the Paris 15, swinging like a heavy champion boxer. And in fact, they've taken the gloves off in preparation for bare-knuckle fisticuffs. The world's leading scientists, and he goes on to talk about what they're saying, and peak emissions must be achieved by 2020, a slap-in-the-face wake-up call issued by the Gathering of Scientists in South Korea. Okay, what's the likelihood that we're going to stop at 1.5? Not now. because I don't see any industries willing to sacrifice profit, market share, in order to make that transition that quickly. So when you put all the pieces together, then we have to have more than simply euphemisms and people saying, well, we'll rebuild. So we're not. I'm Gary Noll. That's our report. I'll be having 10 more parts to this series alone. Before we take a break, please read our latest on Wikipedia. We have many more articles coming in that. It is up to you now to take that information and deal with it. Share it with everyone you can. Share it with the Inspector General, the Internal Revenue Service, every member of Congress, every member of every state, the Attorney Generals. There's a lot wrong with Wikipedia, and here's why you should be concerned. This is from the Free Thought Project. Like a death blow, Facebook Twitter purge destroys free speech, tries to kill independent media. Facebook and Twitter have destroyed thousands of livelihoods, wiped out the independent media from their platforms, and dealt a death blow to free speech. Some 800 anti-establishment accounts and pages have been yanked from Facebook in a sweeping crackdown. The social media giant framed as a fight against spammers. RT talked to us about targeting, they're being targeted in this cleansing. Among the hundreds of pages and accounts Facebook and Twitter took down were those both on the political left and right, ranging from conspiracy theorists and police brutality watchers to news outlets with non-mainstream angles. While their content may be at times described as controversial, the bulk of the banished pages boasted large followings and outreach. RT spoke to some of the voices silenced by Facebook Move. Here's what they had to say. And Jason Bassler, the Free Thought Project, 3.1 million followers, bills itself as the, quote, hub for free thinking conversations. Both its Facebook and Twitter accounts were shut down in the pre-midterm purge. Jason Bassler, who co-founded the project in 2013, told RT that what Facebook did is an act of political censorship and has nothing to do with its stated goal to clean up its platform from spam. Every single progressive website I know is being banned on Facebook and Twitter. But here's what you should know. As he said, quote, Facebook and Twitter have destroyed thousands of livelihoods, I would say that Wikipedia, which is a part of that, has destroyed lives and careers with no opportunity to correct, going against its own rules, and it's equally culpable. So we should be creating independent platforms, social platforms, so people can switch from Facebook and Twitter and Google, no matter how large and powerful they are, to ones that are ethically maintained. Just my thoughts. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Before we go to a little audio clip, I thought you would find it of interest. It's about 32 minutes long, so we're going to play a little bit each day. Here's another thing from a World Socialist website. Pages purged by Facebook were on a blacklist promoted by the Washington Post. This is from Andrea Damon, and it says, media outlets removed by Facebook on Thursday in a massive purge of 800 accounts and pages had previously been targeted in a black list of oppositional sites promoted by the Washington Post in November 2016. The organizations censored by Facebook include Antimedia with 2.1 million followers, the Free Thought Project with 3.1 million, Countercurrents News with 500,000 followers. All three of these groups have been on the blacklist. Okay. So remember, anyone who challenges the establishment is now on a blacklist. So, there it is. Now we're going to go to Brendan O'Neill challenging what the hell happened to liberalism. I think it's interesting. Whether you agree or disagree, we need to hear this.
You are not on Twitter. What kind of human in 2017, public person, editor, is not on Twitter?
I hate Twitter. I think it's become incredibly toxic.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be a tool of free speech where you could express yourself and say what you think and maybe even a space on the internet for people who have different crazy or alternative views. But in many ways, it's become the opposite. It's become a tool for shutting down free speech. You know, the whole Twitch hunt phenomenon,
yeah.
Twitter mobs, anyone who thinks outside of the kind of mainstream liberal PC box can be hounded quite easily.
Yeah.
So I'm not a fan of Twitter. Also, I have a short temper. Just to warn you.
So you're really doing the right thing.
So I don't think I'd be suited to Twitter because I would end up getting into arguments I didn't want to get into.
Yeah. For a free speech guy and an absolutist in this regard, the mobs and all that and the Twitch policing and all of that, you're for them doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
You're not for stopping them doing those things. You're just talking about the process
yeah.
of everyone doing all the stuff you don't
yeah.
like.
It's a difficult one because you don't want any clampdown or restrictions on their right to be a mob. Right,
yeah.
You want to defend the right to form a mob and to say things as a mob. But it does have an impact on freedom of speech and freedom of thought. And it's a point John Stuart Mill makes in On Liberty. John Stuart Mill often argued that the worst kind of censorship is not necessarily legal or state censorship. It's often what he called the informal tyranny of custom,
mm-hmm.
where there's just this expectation that you will go along with the conformist mainstream view. And if you don't, you will in some subtle way be punished, maybe ousted from polite society, maybe a signal will be sent that you're not a good person. I think the Twitter mob phenomenon feeds into that. So in many ways, it can be a more insidious form of censorship than even government censorship.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I say all the time now, it's that at the moment, and of course this can change, but at the moment, I'm not that concerned about government censorship. At the moment. That being said, what I am concerned about is that we're silencing ourselves really because everyone is afraid of the outrage machine. And that's why I've tried to consistently bring on people like you who, although you're not on Twitter, who are just out there doing it, and you're still alive. And as Douglas Murray said to me, the water ain't that cold. You know,
that's exactly
get out
right.
there and do it.
Yeah, I think the worst kind of censorship now is self-censorship. Almost cowardice is a strong word, but I think with some people it's a cowardice about saying what they really think. With other people it's a genuine fear that if they say what they think they will be hounded or demonized and so on. Self-censorship is the real danger now, and there's a lot of it going on. People who are not speaking freely and openly because they fear the consequences, and the consequences can be quite severe. You can have your workplace hounded with emails saying you should sack this guy because he thinks A, B, or C. Of course, you can be hounded off campus by informal gangs of feminists or PC people or even trans people.
Yep.
The government has no involvement in that, but it does nonetheless have this very insidious, profound impact on the general freedom of society and the general sense that everything should be sayable, everything should be debatable, everything should be up for discussion. That idea is being demolished not by government jackboots, but increasingly by these informal gangs of PC enforcers.
Yeah, where do you think that the companies themselves, the tech companies, so Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc., what responsibility do they have? Because everyone knows they have their own terms of service. We're putting this on YouTube. Nobody's forcing me to be on YouTube. Nobody's forcing me to be on Twitter. Again, you're not on Twitter, a wise man. but what responsibility related to free speech do you think they have? Because they've booted off some people
yeah.
that I think are actually decent. I'm not talking about some of the, you know, people that are actually making death threats, which of course is a legal issue, but they've put some people like Sargon of Akkad, who I've had on my show a couple times, they've booted him off Twitter.
I think they have a large responsibility in relation to freedom of speech. And there was a Supreme Court case in this country decades ago about corporate towns, which are these towns built up around corporations mm-hmm. and so on. And one of these corporate towns, or a few of these corporate towns, argued that they didn't have to adhere to the First Amendment because they were private entities. And the judgment that was made in the Supreme Court case was that if you are a private enterprise, which is so large that you legitimately incorporate a huge amount of public space, a huge amount of the public sphere in which people speak, in which people interact, then you do actually have a responsibility to defend freedom of speech. And I think that certainly goes for social media companies.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's now a public arena. That's the, if you look at Facebook, like a seventh of humanity is on Facebook, or Twitter, millions of people on Twitter, millions and millions of people on YouTube. These are the new public forums. These are the new public squares. These are the new spaces in which people stand up, make pronouncements, get on soapboxes, hand out pamphlets, engage their fellow citizens. So I think it's entirely legitimate to expect that the same free speech that we hope would apply in a public square would apply in these forums too.
So is there a little bit of a problem there, because we're going to talk about your Marxist libertarian views in a little bit, but as someone that, at least going off the second part of that, the libertarian side, I know for me, the idea of having the government come in and now tell Facebook and YouTube what to do, even though I have my frustrations with them, I don't really see that as the answer here. What I see is the answer is capitalism and competition, and let other companies come and hopefully, you know, give a little competition so they have to give us a better service. But I struggle with this one. And interestingly, I see a lot of people on the right who are supposed to be the libertarians and the limited government guys calling for these places to be regulated, you know, sort of like they did to AT&T a year, you know, years ago.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because on the one hand, you don't want the government to tell these social media companies to prevent people from saying certain things, which is happening in Britain at the moment. Lots of politicians are kind of ganging together to force Twitter and other forums to restrict certain things, hate speech and so on. So you don't want that. But on the other hand, you don't necessarily want the government to force these companies to preserve freedom of speech or to publish things that they might not want to publish as a private organization. So it is difficult. There's no question about that. But my preference would be that we would encourage these kind of companies and encourage social media platforms to value freedom of speech in its entirety, which means freedom of speech not only for people who we like and who are agreeable and who are interesting and sensible and liberal and nice and so on, but also for people who are edgy and difficult and controversial and contrarian and maybe even hateful, on the basis that it's only by having the fullest freedom of expression possible that we can all then work out what we think is right and wrong. That's the only possibility of arriving at any kind of truth, where everything is up for grabs, everything is stated publicly, and then you trust the audience, you trust the viewers, you trust the listeners to decide for themselves, using their autonomous minds, what's good and what's bad. That's the kind of culture we need to cultivate.
Yeah. Is there a doubly difficult problem here? Because also,
we're out of time for today. We'll continue with this tomorrow, and we'll continue sharing with you the important issues of our time. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.